From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those who love Jane Austen, it's often hard to pin it down, that affection. A good part of it is the characters in her novels, the Elizabeth Bennets, the Charles Bingleys, the Eleanor Dashwoods. Virginia Woolf has said that Austen's characters are so well composed that readers come to see them as if they were living people. The writer Shannon Hale based a book on this phenomenon, in particular one woman who has become obsessed with Mr. Darcy. This year is the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice, which is a good opportunity to talk about Jane Austen and her work, which really brought novels into the modern era. The characters, the sense of irony, and, of course, the romance. Let's not forget that. Jane Austen today, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the Utah writer Shannon Hale first read Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, it was a romance novel, and she loved it. When she read it again later in her life, it had changed. She was still in love with the Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet part, but this time it was not romance as much as it was a biting social commentary. The scholar Claire Harmon says this is common for people who read Jane Austen to live in these different, mutually exclusive spheres. Some will see her work as satire of 18th-century provincial life. Others will see sincerity and nostalgia, even romance, of course. This year marks the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice, and it's giving us an opportunity to talk about Jane Austen, her work, and her remarkably enduring popularity. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. What do you admire most about Jane Austen and her writing? Is she just an extremely talented romance writer, or are you seeing something in there beneath the simple plots of love? 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Claire Harmon is with us. She's the author of four literary biographies, including Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. She's currently working on a biography of Charlotte Bronte, and she's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Oxford, England. And Claire Harmon, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's very nice to be here, or there.
There, right. Well, I want to start with this. I mean, it's something in your book that you point out that, of course, Jane Austen has become this global phenomenon. And you say, though, that a lot of her success lately, anyway, has everything to do with recognition and sometimes little to do with reading. What do you mean?
Yes. Well, I think that is pretty self-evident when you think about it, because a lot of Austen's fans are people who pick up on her fame and who recognize her name and who know that she is the author behind some very well-loved films and some spin-off products. And the films themselves made an enormous difference to that. It meant that Austen went into corners of the culture, which the books hadn't actually, for all their popularity and for all the years they've been in print, they hadn't penetrated as far as these other forms of media, you know, which really are universal, very attractive, very addictive, as, you know, Shannon's book shows. Yeah. And that recognition is obviously a part of fame, and Austen has it in spades. I mean, she just has so much recognizability factor.
You tell the story in the book, in the preface of the book, how the director of a Jane Austen festival in England sent the first chapters of Pride and Prejudice to some British publishers.
Yeah.
She changed the title, of course. She changed the names, and they all rejected it.
Exactly, which, of course, is a great joke because, you know, Austen herself was rejected many times as a young writer, and there's a rejection letter from Thomas Cadell in 1797. He didn't even bother reading the book. But, yes, rejection is part of the response that she, you know, that we can laugh at now. But yes, imagine not being able to recognize that very famous first sentence, for instance. But again, in Shannon's, in the film version anyway, one of Shannon's characters has memorizes Pride and Prejudice, and the other one doesn't know what she's talking about,
right,
mentioning the name of the book. All she knows about is Mr. Darcy. You know, so that's an example of this recognizability, of the way that these the power of Austen's creations has just sort of gone past the book. It's sort of outside the book as well as inside the book, and it's in the culture in a way that's, of course, quite incontinent, if you understand what I mean. It's you can't contain it, you can't control it, that's why it's powerful.
Yeah, you write about, of course, you sort of explore the history of this popularity, her fame, which you describe as one of changing public tastes and critical practices. Does it go in a cycle? Is there sort of this evolving sensibility about Jane Austen?
It has been in cycles, and now it just seems to be like a virus, you know, that really is hard to, if one wished to eradicate it, you'd be hard-pressed to do it. But before which really was a watershed moment for Austen fame, before the 1995 BBC miniseries that, you know, is the Colin Firth one, there was a sort of cyclical feel to Austen's fame. She went in and out of favour, in other words. You know, she had advocates and then she had detractors, and they'd have little sparring matches. You know, there were the late 19th century, you'd have the Janeites, it was a new word, and then you'd have the kind of anti-Janeites, people like, Henry James was very disdainful of the whole Jane Austen fame phenomenon. You know, so you'd have people trying to sort of bolster her reputation up, and then people trying to detract from it. But now nobody actually seriously bothers to try to denigrate Jane Austen's name, because it's just hopeless. And anyway, what would you be denigrating? You'd be, as I said, you know, kind of attacking a recognizability rather than actually an author.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been following the Jane Austen on the banknote issue in Great Britain, but she's been chosen there, I think, for her sort of placebo value. I mean, she's a very safe subject to choose as a female banknote appearance. You know, she's not going to rock the boat very much. People are going to agree that Jane Austen stands for gentility, for cultural, you know, values, for a sort of intelligent irony, and yet, you know, sort of a winking good humour. So, I mean, there's really, if they tried to choose, say, Charlotte Bronte or Mary Wollstonecraft or Virginia Woolf as a female writer on that banknote, they'd have had a lot more of a case to make. But Jane Austen just walks in and everybody says yes.
Well, you mentioned the last century or so. Shakespeare and Austen, they seem to be the only two to withstand all of these shifts of taste and fashion, which boils down to what? I mean, just the essential quality of the work, right?
Well, you can't get to that state of national treasuredom without having some serious quality at the bottom of it. Yeah. And obviously Austen is I think, unquestionably a great author. But, you know, some people have thought her very small, certainly compared with Shakespeare, whose vision is quite different and whose genius is quite different. And it's really hard to cross-compare authors in that way. But you can certainly link them in the terms of their appeal. I mean, their sort of persistent appeal and the way that they touch people's hearts. I mean, Austen has this peculiar quality of really speaking to people, and it's not just women, but it's particularly women, about you know, what it's like to be a woman, and it's about fallibility too. It's not about glorifying females at all, if you think of the women in Pride and Prejudice even, but in Jane Austen's novels generally. I mean, they're a very motley crew, very realistically depicted, and her sort of candour, as well as her geniality and her incredible sort of perception about how people relate to each other, it can last you a lifetime, you know, and it makes for a very valuable author to have around and to be praising.
You say Jane Austen became a great writer in part because she was a great reader. And you mention, of course, her books are full of readers and people reading books. What is it that she liked to read? What were the things that she was reading that seemed to be influencing her?
Well, she was no literary snob. She liked all sorts of works, and she particularly liked novels. Novels at the end of the 18th century were not thought of as a particularly high taste. They were, you know, thought to be a little bit risque, a bit rough and ready. I mean, poetry and drama would have been, and history would have been more acceptable things to admit you liked. But Jane Austen said that they were all great novel readers in her family, and not ashamed to say so. And she loved sort of a jolly good read. I mean, she liked quite sort of rip-snorting Gothic novels, and she also liked, erudite literature. Mm. She liked a good story, and she knew that that's what a reader wanted, and that's what she was going to give. I mean, she was never going to make her novels too didactic or too philosophical, because she just wanted to get on, you know, and her novels do get on. Boom, boom, boom. I mean, it's just one thing after another. They're succinct. There's very little fine writing. There are very few purple passages or even descriptive passages. I mean, she wants conversation. She wants action. She wants to stir things up in the little world that she's created. And it's so she really does understand what a good read entails, and she provides it. In fact, that's probably, I mean, she's almost too successful, because she makes her stories really readable. I mean, I read them, I don't know about you, but I read them when I was a teenager, sort of age 13 or 14, and then I read them again at a sort of late teenage stage. I'd been told that they were funny, and I thought, my goodness, where's the humour in this? But then I saw that they were funny. I first read them as sort of, you know, Regency novels, just plots and romances. And then I began to see the humour. And of course, you know, the more you reread them, the more you see that she's packaging things up for you. But it's accessible at every level. So she's never going to lose parts of her audience, because there's something for everyone, really.
It's interesting, the kind of myth of Jane Austen. I mean, you write about that in your book, that there was this sense that this mythical Jane Austen was really self-conscious about her writing, that, you know, she would sort of put her writing aside when the servants would come in, or someone who wasn't really intimately connected with her. But you say that's not true, that she wasn't too precious about writing, that this was just a part of their lives, that the Austens.
Yes, she wasn't made to feel embarrassed about it. I mean, quite a lot of young women would have, you know, had a family situation that they might have been frowned on for trying to write. But the Austen family were very open-minded about that. Her father encouraged her. And yes, she had no qualms about it at all. When her father was alive, you know, he was the person who solicited publication for that first, well, the first time that we have a letter that survives from them. Mm-hmm. And she was sort of 20, 21, and it was an early version of Pride and Prejudice. So she was, she felt very much at home with scribbling, with juvenilia, with all sorts of production like that, and just assumed that there'd be no particular barrier to her. And that story about her hiding her work, it really comes from post 1870, when her nephew, James Edward Austen Leigh, wrote a memoir of her. And that was when all the myths about Jane Austen got set in stone. And they were, you know, it was a nephew's point of view. It was a respectful family point of view. Mm-hmm. And it was wishful. He wanted her to be presented as a totally undisturbing character. You know, which clearly she was a charming aunt, could be a charming woman, but she was also, you know, intelligent, satirical, quite hard-nosed about money, and ambitious. Not ambitious in a way that was going to upset her nephew. I mean, he wasn't going to ever go round to tea and hear his aunt complaining about things at all. So, you know, but in her letters, you can see that she's, you know, really interested in getting published and in what sort of deal she'll get with the publishers and in what the reception will be like.
Well, it seems like this is what a lot of people like about Jane Austen, was not that she was this genteel woman, but that she, I mean, you get a sense from her writing that she could be kind of snarky.
Oh, dear.
You know, acid-tongued, I think is how you describe it. But,
yes. You
know, a lot of people don't really see her that way. But you say she could be cynical. She was quite worldly. Mm-hmm. And you get a sense that the family probably was maybe sitting around reading other people's books, making fun of how badly they were written.
Oh, and exactly. But of course, unlike today, when everybody's opinions are out on the web, or, you know, nobody can have an opinion without it being broadcast virtually. I mean, in Jane Austen's day, I mean, her opinions would have been very much kept to herself and her family circle. And that's why it's only in the letters of Jane Austen, most of which were written to her sister Cassandra, that you begin to see this tone. And then you can Obviously, you can see her cynicism and worldliness in the novels too, but it's very much packaged up as, in charming sort of accoutrements. So you don't, you can understand her irony, but it's a very generous tone in the novels, and that's what makes her so beloved. But when the letters were first published, it was in 1932, I think, quite a lot of people were shocked at this revelation of Jane Austen's, home tone, as it were, where she was being snarky and she was pointing out, the bad breath of some neighbours and just the ugliness of people and meannesses. And one critic, I think it was Harold Nicholson, said that, that's Vita Sackville-West's husband, said that it showed a mind like a small, sharp pair of scissors, and a disagreeable mind. And E.M. Forster also said that he found it quite surprising, that he still loved her. He said that, that he was a bit kind of wary who he'd fallen in love with there. And there was an amazing story from Austen's lifetime. After she had become a published author and was still anonymous, so she wasn't seeking to be known at all as a writer, but the secret was out, in a limited way. Mm-hmm. And one mutual friend told Mary Russell Mitford, the writer, that she had been to visit the Austens and that Jane Austen had sat absolutely silently through the whole tea-taking, just looking daggers at everybody. And this mutual friend said that she used to do exactly that before she was known to be an author. And she said she always looked like a poker by the fireside, but now she's a poker of whom everyone is afraid. And just that sense of someone being a silent observer. And when you know that they've written novels like Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice and Mansfield Park, and you know that they could be just watching you and getting ready to expose your own frailties in a novel that will be very popular. I mean, that's quite a terrific power. And she wasn't frightened of just sitting there and making people feel uncomfortable.
Claire Harmon is with us, the author of the book Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. I want to get Shannon Hale involved in this conversation, but we need to take a break first of all. We invite you to join us, by the way. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Jane Austen. It's the 200th anniversary this year of Pride and Prejudice, one of the most beloved novels of all time. We're asking why. What is it about that book or any of Austen's characters that make them so enduring and so popular? A lot of you encountered Austen through films and TV. That BBC production of Pride and Prejudice was something of a phenomenon. There's even a clique of Austen fans called Janeites. We're talking about all of that today with Claire Harmon, the author of Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. We also have with us Shannon Hale, who's the author of 10 children's books and young adult novels. They include the Newbery Honor-winning book Princess Academy. Her book Austenland has been adapted into a feature film. It's screening tonight. The Broadway Center Cinemas will give you the details about that as we go along. And Shannon Hale, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So we were talking before with Claire Harmon about, she was mentioning how she encountered, when she first encountered, I think it was Pride and Prejudice, that it was one thing, and then she read it later and it became another thing, and that you had the same kind of experience.
I did. I first read it when I was in high school, just from word of mouth. I'd heard of Jane Austen. It wasn't assigned. And I thought it was the most beautiful romance I'd ever read. Then when I read it in college, it suddenly, I read it a couple times between then, but in the college setting, it became this biting social commentary. Mm. And I was applying feminist theory and Marxist theory to it. And suddenly I wrote a whole essay about how it's not a romance at all. It's about class and women being enslaved and the power of money and all these sorts of things, which it was. Yeah. I was right.
Yeah.
But then when I read it again, a little bit older, it was funny. It was just funny. The whole thing was hysterical.
But you hadn't caught that before, the funny part.
I hadn't. didn't. Yeah. I had it. I was too young at one point, and then I was too intense looking at all the other details of the satire. And then when I saw that it was truly just funny, and of course the words hadn't changed, what changed is I had changed. And I think that's what is enduring about Austen, is that what she wrote changes with you. There's so many layers, and it's done so deftly that whatever age or circumstance you read it in, it's going to be the book for you.
Yeah. That funny part is important. Claire Harmon, how important is that part? I mean, and do a lot of people miss the humor at first?
Well, as Shannon was saying, I think you're likely to miss it when you're younger, because there is, I mean, just it does seem incredibly amusing. I mean, people like Mr. Collins, apart from being cringeworthy, are just hilariously good comic characters. And you just, as Shannon was saying, one enjoys it more and more, and these things stay with you, and they just get richer and richer. And I think it's a wonderful phenomenon. I mean, you could just really keep that book on a desert island and read it over and over again and laugh every time. Actually, it surprises you every time as well. I mean, with Pride and Prejudice, one's always, you know, gasping at the end when they actually get together. You think, is it going to work out? You know, it's going to work out.
Yeah.
There's nothing more certain. But, you know, there's suspense. There's this kind of refreshment of the pleasure of reading every time. It is an incredible ability on Austen's part.
Shannon Hale, you've talked about this, that it's tricky doing an adaptation, a film adaptation of Jane Austen, because you strip out, you have to, or most do anyway, you have to strip out the role of the narrator.
Right.
And that's often the funny part.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that when people just know Jane Austen from her films, you look at the Keira Knightley version, it's this gorgeous, lush romance, but it's not funny. And so when you tell people Pride and Prejudice is actually a comedy, you wouldn't know that because you strip out the narrator. And I think that's wonderful thing about Jane Austen's narrator is it sounds like it's her voice. And while I'm reading her books, I kind of go throughout my day feeling like I've got her over my shoulder, like whispering comments in my ear, and I can see the world through her eyes. And it's a really fun, intelligent, witty, sardonic voice that I love. And you do lose that in the movies. But nevertheless, I love the movies still, even losing the comedy part, even losing her voice,
yeah,
because her characters are so good and her story's so good that I am right there willing to get swept up in the romance of it.
It's interesting. You when you talk about Mr. Darcy and your affection for Mr. Darcy, which is a critical part of the film, Austenland, which we'll talk about here in a moment. But when you talk about your affection for Mr. Darcy, it doesn't seem like it's ever really disconnected, and I'm not sure how you could ever do this, of course, but from Elizabeth Bennet. I mean,
right,
they're connected, right? I mean, they're not. It's not just – you don't just put him there. It's part of your affection for him is how she's connected to him, I guess.
He is his relationship with Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what is appealing about his character, absolutely. I don't think you can remove Mr. Darcy from the Elizabeth Bennet equation without losing his sexiness, because I think when I and many of my friends, when we would go to Pride and Prejudice, we identified with Elizabeth Bennet, and we wanted –
In what way?
Well, she is – not that pretty, not as pretty as her sister. She's not nearly as talented or accomplished as many young women. And she has no money, so she's not wealthy. There's nothing really that great about her. And I think that all of us at some time, but especially when we're younger, feel like everybody else is better than us and we're just not noticeable. But what Elizabeth had, which is what I think we hoped, my friends and I, that we had, was wit and cleverness. And she was smart. She was just a smart cookie. And you kind of hope, I wish people could see that in me. I'm not glitzy and beautiful and accomplished, and I'm not the ballerina, and I'm not the student body president, and I'm not the head cheerleader, but I got something, don't I? And then Mr. Darcy sees it. She's got nothing to recommend her, as he says, but he still can't help falling in love with her. And that's very appealing.
Yeah. Claire Harmon, was that a controversial idea at the time? This idea that the girl sort of in the middle, the Elizabeth Bennet, who didn't have all of the prospects, didn't quite have the beauty of the sister, that she would be the – I mean, is that part of the appeal back then, or was that in some way controversial for its time?
It was quite controversial. I mean, obviously Elizabeth Bennet is a very original kind of heroine. There had been sort of ill-favored heroines before, but they hadn't got very far, if you can see.
Yeah.
I mean, Elizabeth Bennet with her fine eyes, I mean, that's enough. Austen's not going to actually say that she's, you know, not as beautiful as her sister Jane, but her spirit and her character is so vibrant. And as Shannon was saying, it's a remarkably comforting and powerful narrative to have that kind of girl who is highly intelligent and who's also very principled, winning through. And actually just by, I mean, obviously she makes mistakes too. She has mistakes of perception and she is prejudiced, and she's also, she's proud as well as Darcy being proud, and she gets past that. But, you know, she has this little bit of a learning curve, and then, hey, she wins the lottery. I mean, she
does.
It all comes out fine in the end, but she doesn't seem to have really sacrificed anything. You know, she hasn't had to sacrifice much. She's just had a little few tweaks to her enthusiasms and her expectations. But it's a wonderful invention because it doesn't make her have to be an ill-favored girl. But, you know that her attractiveness is mostly and irrepressibly through her spirit and through her character and her principles.
I know it's an obvious line of questioning, but you do wonder, did Jane Austen relate to Elizabeth Bennet in that way?
Oh, yes, totally.
did she?
And she said that, she loved Elizabeth as a creation, and she said anybody who doesn't like Elizabeth, you know, I won't understand how they can't love that character. So, I mean, I think it was obviously a fantasy projection, but Elizabeth's got all the sort of wittiness that Jane Austen had herself, and all the sort of aspirations to shine, and this and the younger sister thing too. You know, Cassandra Austen, Jane's elder sister, was quite a dominant figure in Jane's life, and being the kind of younger, bubbly, but, you know, perhaps subservient sister, that comes through as well.
She emulated Cassandra, and when her engagement ended, Cassandra's, because her fiancé had died tragically, Jane, you say, seemed to lose interest in the idea of marriage as well?
Yes, so that she, I mean, I feel that she was then trying to just stay with Cassandra and support her sister. You know, she'd been described as a husband-hunting butterfly when she was a teenager. You know, actually a real party animal. She loved dancing, and she clearly loved sort of acting up a bit at parties. But then she became, with her sister, quite prematurely sort of somber in public anyway. You know, they sort of adopted middle-aged clothes rather early. Mm. But she had all this stuff simmering underneath, clearly. And Elizabeth Bennet does epitomise all the stuff about Jane Austen that she would have liked to have enacted, I'm sure, including the marrying Darcy.
Right. Well, she's at 25 years of age. She's unmarried. She's still unpublished at this point in her life. And you say in your book that at this point in her life, she's unsure if her style of writing really does have a future. I mean, she's developed a certain style, but these books, these early manuscripts, these early versions of Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, they're sitting on a shelf in her room.
Yeah, it's a really odd and interesting fact because, you know, 200 years ago when Pride and Prejudice was published, that book had been, you know, she'd had it around in her room for, you know, 15 years or so. Mm. She'd been writing for almost 20 years. I mean, writing with a view to publication. You know, she was very precocious as a teenager. She was writing very sophisticated works. And then this first version of Pride and Prejudice was ready in 1797. Wasn't accepted. In fact, the publisher wrote refused by return of post on the letter. So, you know, I mean, goodness, what a mistake that was in publishing terms. But it took, you know, another 15 years to get that book in print. And all the time she had that book, other people were publishing. Obviously, you know, the world was moving on. The period was so tumultuous. I mean, the whole Napoleonic Wars, the Regency, and her books must have seemed to her to be very much in danger of being obsolete 1790s romances. And I think she took out a lot of topical references to make them timeless and more acceptable in 1813.
Well, you say in the book, this is a good thing. I mean, the longer she remained unpublished, the more experimental, you say, she became too.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case, because the first book that she actually got money for, but it wasn't published, was a book called Susan. She sold that in 1803, and it's very probably Northanger Abbey. I mean, you know, it seems to be an early version, although the manuscript doesn't exist, of Northanger Abbey. But she was unhappy about that book when finally she got the rights back in 1816 because she thought it was out of date. And, you know, she had been quite experimental in the late 1790s, but she understood what the contemporary writing scene was like. And she just had to, you know, keep refining her books and hoping I think they did become quite sort of postmodern in a way. I mean, there's quite a lot in her works that seems, I mean, in Northanger Abbey itself, she's got a little bit towards the end where she says, reader, you can see that we're heading towards a happy ending because there are so few pages left. So she makes a joke about the actual number of pages. You know, so you and I both know that this is going to work out okay and they're going to get married because, you know, hey, you can see only 10 pages left. And here it is, the happy ending. I mean, she's got this sort of relaxed, cheeky feel to that narrative voice. It's very funny and very clever.
Shannon,
and really, not repeated for 100 years or so.
Right, right. That, you know, the literary aspect to it. Not even the characters, not even the writing. Did that resonate with you, Shannon Hale, as a woman who was trying to get published, who was working through all of this, who thought about structure and whether her work is relevant, all of that? Did that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Jane Austen and Clara talked about how she's not just her book. She's become, you know, much more than that. And she's the lady writer. I believe, is that right, Claire, that originally when her first book she's published, it didn't have her name. It just said by a lady.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, and you do feel resistance, as I think, as a woman in a lot of arenas, and to think she's almost like a mentor or, you know, a mascot in a way. Well, there's always Jane Austen, our lady writer.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let me take a call from Nathan, who's with us in
Hello.
Sandy. Nathan, welcome. Go ahead.
You asked what makes her character so enduring, and one of the things I've noticed is, as I've taken some of the popular personality tests that are available for us today, is that you can actually apply them to her characters and get meaningful character results, like the kind of the phlegmatic nature of Elizabeth Bennet's father and those kinds of things. It's amazing.
What about that, Shannon Hale, this idea of the characters? I mean, obviously that's one of the things that stands out. I mean, I was mentioning the Virginia Woolf quote about how they kind of come alive. I mean, this is something that you think a lot about, for certainly in your writing of Austenland, that Darcy actually comes alive.
They are real. They feel like your friends. And I think one way, real tangible way, where I've been affected by Jane Austen's novels is when you read all of them, none of her main characters are the same. And here she has very distinct, unique female characters that are really nothing alike each other, even though they live in very similar circumstance and very similar part of and time of the world. And it became a goal of mine to never repeat the same character and make sure I was giving justice to all the very many different kinds of people there in the world, and specifically women, because I think that female characters are the ones that are most often reduced to stereotypes.
Yeah. Is this in some way, Claire Harmon, the quality of her characters, I guess it has to be asked, were these just neighbors or were they in fact creations?
Well, some of the neighbors thought that they were the neighbors. When the books started coming out, she got some, you know, frosty looks from neighbors. But then, of course, that became a great game to wind people up by making them think that they might have been models. But no, as Shannon was saying, there's an incredible fecundity to her imagination. I mean, she just does. She picks these characteristics out. And as your caller was saying, too, you know, they are types, but they're also completely believable and individualized. I mean, their language, I think, is the thing. I mean, she makes people's talk very natural. And, you know, every time Mrs. Bennet opens her mouth, you just know she's going to say a Mrs. Bennet-y thing. You know, she's just trapped in her own personality in the way that we all are. But, you know, Austen sends this up to such comic effect without ever making it predictable. But it's always just spot on. You know, she just does more of the stuff that she does, that character. And Mr. Collins as well, you know, he's so disgustingly creepy. But he's never reduced to a sort of stereotype. He's always, his creepiness modifies and modulates, and you think, oh my goodness, you know, there's more to this horrible man.
Right. Well, one of the questions is, was this unique for the era? Because you do write about the fact that she moved the novel into the modern era, and did it, you say, before she got a single word in print. I mean, this was this kind of writing, the naturalistic dialogue, for example, the tone, the irony, I suppose, was unique, right, for that era, the writing that she was doing.
Yes, and the lightness of it. When you think of the ponderous books she loved, like Fanny Burney's novels, you know, big, long, heavy-going books, which were also comedies and had a, you know, massive amount of energy in them. But Austen's books were so sort of short and zippy, and it's as if she'd kind of anticipated all sorts of things about the media that have loved her works, you know, like illustrated books, film, television, radio. Mm. I mean, all those things, it's as if she knew that you had to kind of get your message across quicker and more amusingly than anybody had done previously, anybody in the novel had done.
I love you cite one description of the Jane Austen plot, the monoplot, boy meets girl, girl gets boy.
Yes, that's six words for six novels. I think that's a brilliant precis. It's actually it's Sylvia Townsend Warner said that. That's the subject of my first book, was this a committed Jane Austen fan, and I think it's a brilliant precis of the novels, yeah. Girl gets boy.
Yeah. The sense of irony, of course, always comes up. Seems to be one of the most important characteristics. Is that kind of the, Claire Harmon, kind of the secret sauce for Jane Austen, that kind of sophisticated irony?
It's some of the sauce. It's quite secret, as we were saying. It's not always the first thing that strikes a reader on their first reading. Mm. But it's very much, I mean, she's got such a mixture, because if she was just an ironist, we'd be thinking of her as a sort of sneery, you know, removed figure. But she's also got this complete dedication to the plot. She's got a total commitment to romance literature. She also wants to be funny and is funny. She's got this great, fresh language. And she's also, she's a moralist, but she is not at all preachy. So her morals are completely acceptable. You just think, yes. And the irony and the moralism are sort of so hand in hand, you just don't know you're being moralized.
Right.
And you also don't know that there's being irony worked on you. In fact, you're just her puppet. I mean, she just, you know, she's just so much in control of the reader. It's brilliant.
I love this, though. You're right. You describe her as a jolly Samuel Beckett.
Yeah, I think that's what she's like. Yes.
Shannon Hill, what about you, the sense of irony? How does that work on you? Has that worked on you as a writer and a reader?
She's so smart. When I read Jane Austen, I find myself, you know, you just start nodding and you want her to like you, you know? You're like, yeah, I think you could be my best friend. And I really want you to be my best friend. And you just can't help going along with her. I find, you know, sometimes I read a novel and I realize I can't do what this writer is asking me to do. I can't go with them on the story where they want me to go. Mm. Or I don't feel like I'm in competent hands. I'm worried that the writer's not going to take care of me. With Jane, you just, I could say Jane like I know her. My pal Janie.
You kind of do.
Yeah. You just, I guess that's part of it, isn't it?
We feel like
we
know
her. You just go with her. You know you're in competent hands and you want to go with her wherever she's going to take you.
The simplicity of her, again, that sort of monoplot, but also how zippy they are, as Claire Harmon was talking about. Did you take note of that, too, as a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it gave me further appreciation. When I studied in college, I read a lot of her contemporaries, and everybody else, by comparison, was just horrible. I think of all these great novelists that were writing at the same time period.
Really ponderous.
Yeah. And I think what struck me really was the structure was just not there. As a writer, I could tell that the structure drove me nuts. It just was not very clean and well-crafted. And the characters weren't very real. And then there was just sort of awkward racism and sexism running rampant. And so a lot of these books, they just can't be read for pleasure anymore. They're important because they're important historically, but readers are not going to sit down with these books anymore and just enjoy them. Whereas Jane Austen was just so smart. She just made the novel what we think of it as today by figuring out well-rounded characters and a structure that works.
She wasn't at all defensive, was she? I mean, a lot of women writers at the time felt they had to appear to be learned or coarse, you know, and Jane Austen wasn't taking any of that. She was going to speak in her own voice. One of the very early readers of Pride and Prejudice was Annabella Milbank, who ended up, weirdly enough, marrying Lord Byron the next year. But the year when she read Pride and Prejudice, she said that what struck her was it was the most probable fiction she'd ever read. And that's a really interesting observation about that novel, that it is very likely, unlike all the other sort of sensationalist literature of the time. You know, she said there were no drownings, no conflagrations, no runaway horses, just this probability, this kind of realistic fiction. But then on top of it, in comes Darcy. So you have the probable, realistic side plus this big fantasy man walks in. You know, what a winning combination.
Claire Harmon is with us. She's the author of the book Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. Shannon Hale with us, the author of, a lot of books, among them Austenland, which has been adapted into a feature film, which is screening, by the way, tonight for free, the Broadway Center Cinemas, which begins at 7 o'clock. There is also a Tea Time fundraiser that is for the Salt Lake Film Society today at 1 o'clock. It's all a celebration of Hale's book. We've got all the details about those events on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Nathan, thanks for the call. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Jane Austen. We have Claire Harmon with us, the author of Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. And we have the Utah writer Shannon Hale with us. She's the author of the book Austenland, which has been adapted into a feature film. It premiered at Sundance this year, and there's a free screening of it tonight at the Broadway Center Cinemas. You can find those details on our website. We'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go along. So, Shannon Hale, I want to talk about the book and the movie. Where did you get started on it? I mean, was it your own? Because it's about a woman, Jane is her name, who kind of has this obsession with Jane Austen, in particular, Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet. Talk a little bit about Jane first, your character. She's sort of living in a fantasy world in some way.
She is, yeah. And it really came from, you know, after the Pride and Prejudice miniseries starring Colin Firth came around, yeah. I noticed in
it was
my,
such a turning point for people, right?
It was. in a turning point for world history as
right,
well.
Right.
It just changed my friends and I. I just, as much as we'd loved the books and been reading in Austen, rereading Austen, that movie just was so impactful. And suddenly Colin Firth, Mr. Darcy, became like the ideal man. Yeah. And we became a little obsessive. And I really was just wondering, I wish we could just know for sure. I wish we could just step into an Austen story and know would it really have been that great to be there. And so we used to do these how to host a murder parties, and I got the idea of what if there was an immersive Austen vacation where you could go on and wear the outfits and live in a manor house, and there would be a cast of actors you could interact with. And I thought about the kind of person that would go there. And I worked on the novel off and on for 7 years, and my original character that went there was just wrong for the story. Hmm. I figured it would be very expensive vacation, so she was a wealthy woman, and it just wasn't interesting enough. So I instead wanted to put someone into it that this is like her whole life is at stake, basically, in the outcome of this. And she's so kind of messed up by her obsession that she actually goes to the resort as therapy. It's like immersive therapy, like the equivalent of like locking yourself in a closet and smoking cigars till you throw up to get over smoking.
right.
She's like,
aversion
I can't move
therapy,
forward, yeah. Right, and it's with my life until I get over this. But then, of course, it's both worse and far better than she imagined in many ways.
Yeah. What does it take to be a Janeite, Shannon Hale? I mean, it's this is a term.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it was coined by Kipling in a story he wrote. And originally in his story, they were a group of soldiers that read Jane Austen, which is, so it's ironic that now it's become more of a female-only thing,
yeah,
which I don't think is necessary. I think that her writing is really universal. But in my opinion, Jane Eyde is someone that just loves Jane Austen. But there are different cults and aspects. And, you know, there are certain clubs where you have to read Jane Austen a certain way. Or, you know, it's almost like, you know, there's certain brands of feminism or Christianity that, you know, it's become – in some people it's become very – very serious. And
there's a kind of purism to it.
There is, yeah. And I'm not a purist. I say the more the merrier, and let's look at her from a lot of different angles.
Well, it's interesting that Claire Harmon, that Shannon Hale's talking about how her character Jane is going as therapy, because let's go to that term, Jane Eyde, that you write about this, Rudyard Kipling does coin. He writes about how Kipling, of course, is reading Austen while he convalesces from a stomach operation. And in some ways, I guess it seemed to work. It sort of marks his return to health and this new creative phase. So it was good therapy for Kipling. Talk about this term, Jane Eyde.
Well, it was a late 19th century coinage. And yes, it was really mostly a male group. I mean, especially around the Royal Society of Literature, there was a kind of little gaggle of Janeites. And they were a bit camp about it, actually, I have to say. So it was a sort of refinement club. You know, it was a sort of feeling that this was the distinguishing mark of a refined reader. This was before the kind of general hoi polloi fandom phenomenon, which would have horrified those early Janeites. I mean, they were very fastidious and wouldn't have looked kindly at all on the sort of very jolly parades they have, say, in Bath. You know, the Jane Austen fan club will be marching through the streets of Bath wearing a motley selection of costumes and, you know, just having a good time. I mean, that the old-fashioned Janeites were much more to do with reading and snobbery. And now it's just much more of, you know, self-expression through fandom. And yeah. It's people get an incredible amount out of it.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that during World War I, because you write about this, it was really comforting.
Yes.
For soldiers who were convalescing to be read.
Well, that's a really strange thing, isn't it? Because there was a list drawn up of literature that could and should be read to soldiers who were suffering the most appalling wounds and brain damage as well. And at the top of the list was Jane Austen, because she was thought to be the most pleasing and sort of penetrating author. So she could be understood easily and she would kind of deliver the most to a convalescent, shell-shocked soldier. And also Kipling's story, as you were saying, you know, it's about men in the trenches of all classes, officer class and the privates, getting equal comfort from Jane Austen, her works, and really her vision of England and, you know, what she stands for, what they're fighting for, really, is this peaceful, genteel, feminized, countrified English idyll. The pathos of that when it's set in a battlefield in the Great War is really very marked. It's a terrific story. Mm.
Shannon Hale, you've talked a bit about going to England to shoot the film. You went there, and you've talked about how the crew and the extras, the British there, sort of seemed confused by the conceit of the film.
Yeah, they were. You know, in England, it's very easy to make a Jane Austen-era film because they've all done it. And every British actor has been in a period film. And in fact, one of our actors, J.J. Field, who played Mr. Nobley, he wore the same top hat and jacket that Colin Firth wore in The Pride and Prejudice.
Wow.
Yeah, and so everything, they do historicals every day. And then, the dialogue was so outrageous and not Regency appropriate that people were very confused what was going on. And I remember the actors, it was a term I was unfamiliar with, so I don't know if it's offensive, excuse me, Claire, if it is, but the actors kept saying that we were trying to take the piss out of them. And does that mean trying to take themselves less seriously? Is that right?
Exactly, it does.
I think that was, you know, a bunch of Americans coming in and saying, take the piss out of yourselves, British. And, you know, it's a funny to make a film that is making fun of something at the same time as being the very thing that it is making fun of.
Yeah.
So let's have a romance about how silly romance is. And let's have a real Austen love fest at the same time saying, isn't it silly how obsessed we get over these fictional characters?
Yeah.
But that's also a brilliant satire, Shannon, because, you know, you've got your characters coming over, and you also, when you say that the actors were objecting in terms of its regenciness, perhaps, but, you know, because the whole story is about this peculiar interface between what's in the literature and what's in the films and what's in real life. I mean, you've got everything fighting against each other. It's not just a book and a girl. It's a book and a film and a girl and an actor and a set of other people, and, mm-hmm. and it makes an immensely odd knot of things, which is exactly where Austin gets into all those corners, doesn't she? And that's yeah. why you can work with that material and make such a sort of multifaceted comedy. I think so. I think it's a brilliant idea.
Oh, thank you. And it's fun. All the different the women that go to this resort, they're all different. They all see something different in Jane Austen. They all want something different. And all the men are different because the women want something slightly different. They all like someone might want a Wentworth and someone might want a Willoughby and someone might want a Darcy.
And someone might want a Brandon.
Exactly. Is that your cup of tea, Claire?
I'm afraid so. I'm
you
at that time
me.
Of life.
Yeah. There's just endless things to play with Jane Austen.
Yeah.
To both, while loving her, I felt like we were the right group of people to make it because all of us involved genuinely love Jane Austen. But at the same time, could say, oh, let's laugh at this too.
Well, that it seems like, let me ask you this finally, both of you, because this seems the ultimate irony in some way, that you have a woman who didn't seem to take herself too seriously in the way she wrote. And then you have people who now regard Jane Austen as sacred ground that you can't – you've experienced this, Shannon,
oh,
yourself.
Sure. I've gotten lots of emails. And even one time I was on a national NPR show, and after being interviewed about Austen Land, it was a very kind of strained interview. The host told me, I do not approve of what you've done. I had stepped into sacred cow territory. And I do – because I used to fear like Janeites would come on my lawn with torches and pitchforks.
Right. But that is the irony, right, Claire Harmon? That Jane Austen wouldn't have wanted it that way, it seems.
Well, no, of course she wouldn't have wanted it that way because she was a real person
yeah.
as well as an author. You know, her authorial presence is one thing and we can speculate about that. But, I mean, I think as an actual woman of her time, no, there's no doubt that she would have found it all completely bizarre and alien because, you know, the times are very different. But through her books, I mean, that's how she's communicating, and the books are what we read, and it's not the woman, but it's the works.
Mm. Claire Harmon, author of the book Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World, joined us from the studios of the BBC in Oxford. Claire Harmon, thank you very much for the time.
It's been a pleasure.
And Shannon Hale, the author of the book Austen Land, which has been adapted into a feature film, which is screening tonight at 7 o'clock. It's free at the Broadway Center Cinemas. You should go to our website to find out the particulars about that. Shannon Hale, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. I love Radio West.
Thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.